agus Giadiv. Welcome to The Irish in Canada, the podcast exploring the histories and legacies of Irish immigrants and their Canadian descendants. I'm your host, Jane McGaughey. This is episode number 4, The Battle of the Windmill. Last week, I told you about Edmund Bailey O'Callaghan and the 1837 Lower Canadian Rebellion. Today, we're going to skip ahead to 1838, when O'Callaghan was in exile in the United States, and when the colonies of Upper and Lower Canada were still in chaos after the failed uprisings. The Battle of the Windmill really should be more famous than it is. For those of us who know what happened just east of the town of Prescott, Ontario, on those freezing cold days in November, the battle was a 4-day disaster for the invading Americans. For the rest of the world, however, the Battle of the Windmill is a set piece from George Orwell's Animal Farm. Both battles involved pigs, but unlike the villainy of the Stalinesque pig Napoleon, the wild hogs that ate the corpse of an Irish lieutenant along the banks of the St. Lawrence River were officially exonerated from any wrongdoing by a British court-martial. So, what happened? In mid-November 1838, some 250 hunter patriots landed just outside the hamlet of New Wexford in Upper Canada. The hunter patriots were a group of American, European, and Canadian Republicans who crossed the St. Lawrence River intent on liberating the Canadas from British rule to finish what the Canadian uprisings had started. Led by Niels von Schultz, a brave yet doomed European aristocrat, they crossed the river from New York State in the dead of night, only to be quickly surrounded by imperial troops and the colonial militia. For 5 days, the two sides fought around a stone windmill on a small rise above the shoreline where the hunter patriots had taken shelter. After the British Navy began to bombard the windmill from the river, the hunters surrendered. Von Schultz was hanged after having been defended by a young lawyer from Kingston named John A. MacDonald. 10 others were executed too, and the rest of the hunter patriots were either sent back to America or transported to a penal colony in Tasmania. Why this is also interesting to me is because this invasion brought together 4 distinct strains of the Irish diaspora in one of the more violent episodes from 19th century Canada. Ogle Gowan's Orangemen, yes, them again, fought alongside Irish Catholic Canadian settlers and Protestant descendants of Irish United Empire loyalists, who were in turn supported by regulars from the 83rd Dublin Regiment of Foot against the invading forces. This was a very Canadian battle, but full of Irish immigrants and soldiers. Now, some of you might be asking, were there any Irishmen on the hunter's side? That's a very good question, and the most truthful answer is, maybe. While there were most likely men of both Irish birth and of Irish descent among the hunter patriots, only one secondary source cites the Irish Repeal Movement, the attempt in Ireland to overturn the 1801 Act of Union, as something that directly influenced the hunters' decision to invade, and that source is from 1956. This is what we professional historians refer to as something, quote, worthy of further scholarly attention. In other words, I've already written what I want to say about the Battle of the Windmill, but if you feel like doing this as a graduate thesis, do get in touch. The broad strokes of the Battle of the Windmill sound a lot like other Irish invasions and rebellions. Like Robert Emmet in 1803, the hunter patriots were attempting to provoke a rising after an earlier rebellion had failed. Like the Fenians in the 1860s, the hunters created a network of fraternal societies, clubs, and intelligence gathering on either side of the Canadian-American border, believing that the loss of Canada would be a mighty blow against the British Empire. Now, I always find this line of thinking to be a bit endearing, because it kind of assumes the British actually gave a damn about Canada's place within the empire at this point in the 19th century. I'm sorry, my friends, but we were not the jewel in the crown. We were the lumberyard across the water with some fish thrown in on the side. Like the Fenians nearly 30 years later, the Hunter Patriots found out too late that their plan was not going to work because their secret invasion wasn't a secret. Word of their plans had spread as far away as New York City. James Buchanan was an Irish diplomat serving as the British consul in New York State, and he was worried. He pessimistically thought the executions that had taken place after the rebellions were a disaster, and that the atmosphere of lingering bitterness would create disloyalty and further violence. As an Irishman, Buchanan also felt that the Irish who had fought for the crown during the 1837 rebellions had not been properly acknowledged. If the Hunter Patriots ever invaded the Canadas, Buchanan felt that, quote, "the only part of the militia which will turn out is the Irish, and never has man been worse treated." Sir John Colborne, and by the way, he was commander-in-chief of all of the British forces in the Canadas. Sir John Colborne assured me he attributed the salvation of the two provinces to the Irish, yet the family compact treat them as unworthy either of office, endearment, or confidence. End quote. Someone who was very keen to make the Irish appear more loyal than anyone else was Ogle Gowan, leader of the Orangemen in Upper Canada and commander of the 9th Battalion Militia. On Sunday, November 12th, news reached Gowan in Brockville that a group of some 200 Hunter Patriots had crossed the river and taken up position on the far side of Fort Wellington, beyond the town of Prescott. By 1 p.m. that afternoon, Gowan and his men were on the road, traveling east towards the windmill. Figuring out the actual number of Orangemen who fought at the windmill is a bit difficult. Ogle swore that half his soldiers were Orangemen. However, if you cross-reference the membership lists from Loyal Orange Lodge No. 1 that still exist, with the list of veterans' pensions from the battle, and I did this by hand several years ago because I'm just like that, then the numbers get a bit murky, and that's not just because of my infamous math skills. 81 men joined Loyal Orange Lodge No. 1 in Brockville between 1830 and 1836, but only 12 of these men appear on the official government pay list for the militia, and only 4 of them, Gowan, John Stewart, James R. Wilson, and David Mayer, were part of the 9th Battalion. The membership lists for Loyal Orange Lodge No. 1 stop in 1836, and then resume in the early 1840s, which means knowing exactly who was an Orangeman around Brockville during the rebellion years is virtually impossible. Then again, Orangemen from other local lodges absolutely could have been at the battle, but since many of these early membership rolls are lost, we're back where we started. So, would you take Ogle Gowan's word for it that so many of his soldiers at the windmill were devoted Orangemen? Would you? Really? Orange or not, the men who fought at Windmill Point as part of Team Canada found themselves in an extremely violent battle. The first casualties, however, were women. Mrs. Belden Taylor and her daughter, who lived near the point, tried to escape, but they unfortunately ran into Ogle Gowan's troops. Apparently unable to tell the difference between fleeing women and marauding invaders, the advance party fired, killing Mrs. Taylor instantly and severely wounding her daughter in the jaw. In his memoir, Hunter Captain Daniel Hustis called this a, quote, "unprovoked and barbarous act of cruelty." There were other noted casualties as the battle wore on. Lieutenant John Dolmage, from an Irish United Empire Loyalist family, was one of only 2 officers on the Canadian side to be killed. Even Ogle Gowan didn't escape without a few battle scars. During a bayonet charge, he leapt over a wall and found himself surrounded by hunters. Trying to back up, he apparently impaled himself on the bayonet of one of his own men. In a letter to his cousin James, yes, that James, who was having an affair with Ogle's wife, Ogle described this as a slight wound, quote, "a little below the hip." In fact, he had been stabbed in the buttocks and had to withdraw from the rest of the fighting. As he himself put it, quote, "one inch further to the right would probably have finished me. End quote. Casualties were heavy at the windmill and included the death of an Irish lieutenant of the 83rd Dublin Regiment of Foot. The 83rd Regiment already had a reputation in the colony as, quote, gallant regulars who were supposed to be invincible. Born in County Wicklow, William Johnson had joined the British Army as an ensign in 1815. Nearly 25 years later, he was 39 years old and had risen in the ranks no higher than a lieutenant. Attempting to capture an abandoned cannon in the road near the windmill, he was shot and taken prisoner behind enemy lines. When the fighting ended that night, Lieutenant Johnson was dead. Swine began to eat his corpse. The hunters then stripped his body and strung it by its heels from a nearby tree. Then, in full view of Johnson's men, they cut off his penis. A lot of histories have been written about how much men's bodies mattered in the 19th century in terms of how they represented imperialism, colonialism, capitalism, and sexuality, among many other things. There's no doubt that the hunters mutilated Johnson's body to shock their enemies, to goad them, maybe, into doing something rash. But they might also have been saying something about how weak and effeminate they thought the defenders of Canada were. But the 1800s weren't a time when people talked openly about the deeper meanings of penile dismemberment or castration during battle. Sexual violence was not a thing to be mentioned in polite Canadian society. So, what do you think happened once Johnson's body was brought back to town and the rumors started swirling, and they did swirl, about what the hunters had done to him? You've probably already guessed it. Any mention of Johnson's mutilation quickly disappeared from official stories about the battle. He's listed first among the dead on a plaque at the windmill, and nearly all accounts mention him by name. But until recently, there was very little discussion of what happened once he was taken behind enemy lines. Once the Hunter Patriots had surrendered, and Lieutenant Johnson's body had been cut down from its tree, things got very ugly. Corpses were stripped of their clothes and left to be eaten by wild pigs. Forces fighting for the crown at the Battle of the Windmill sustained over 80 casualties, while as many as 50 of the Hunter Patriots were dead and 160 captured. The surviving hunters were tied separately to a long rope and marched back to Prescott, where they were so abused by loyalist crowds, many of the men broke down in hysterics. Hunter Patriot Stephen S. Wright wrote in his memoir that he was grateful to have the Dublin soldiers standing between him and the Irish-Canadian militiamen as he came out of the windmill, as he thought they, quote, would have torn us to pieces. The militia resembled ravenous fiends more than decent Christian men, end quote. The court-martial for the Hunter Patriots began at Kingston's Fort Henry on November 26, 1838. Courtroom proceedings are fascinating for historians. You find out so much about what matters by the way questions were phrased and answers were given, by the way different individuals used the space as a form of public theater, and what the threat of execution can do to how people behaved. During the trial, it became clear that Colonel Niels von Schultz, the Hunter Patriots' highest-ranking officer, was being held directly accountable for what had happened to Lieutenant Johnson's body. Surgeon William Gardner of the 83rd Regiment was called as a key witness for the Crown. He testified that the cause of death was most likely gunshot wounds. However, the doctor also pointed out that there had been, quote, a mutilation which I perceive to have been performed by a sharp instrument, the excision of the penis, end quote. The news of Johnson's mutilation was apparently a surprise to von Schultz. Although considering the blatant way Johnson's body had been displayed, and the fact that the battlefield around the windmill is less than 100 meters across, it's a bit hard to believe that he hadn't seen what his men had done to Johnson's corpse. The next day, Von Schultz addressed the courtroom. Reading from a prepared statement, he swore that, quote, I tried to get the body away, but the fire was such that I could not. Two men were wounded in the attempt. I put a sentinel to shoot the hogs that might approach the body, and he fired to keep them off. This may show that I had no concern in mutilating his body. End quote. However, Dr. Gardner's testimony that Johnson's penis had been cut off with a sharp instrument, a Bowie knife to be specific, rather than having been nibbled or gnawed at, exonerated the hogs and condemned the colonel. The court found Niels von Schultz guilty, and he was hanged on December 8th at Fort Henry. They say in Kingston that his ghost is the one most often seen when people go up to the fort late at night. The Irishmen who fought at the Battle of the Windmill, the 83rd Dublin Regiment, the Irish Catholic and Protestant settlers, the Orangemen, the Irish United Empire Loyalists, were all part of an event where violence was allowed. This wasn't the Shiners on the Ottawa River or a brawl between orange and green factions in Toronto. Fighting against an invasion gave these Irish settlers a semblance of respectability. Well, some of them. Not our friend Ogle. In the battle's aftermath, Colonel Richard Fraser of the 2nd Grenville Militia accused Ogle Gowan of being a coward and a fool. Insulted, Gowan demanded satisfaction and challenged Fraser to a duel. But despite Ogle having received official commendations for his military service at the Battle of the Windmill, Colonel Fraser refused to fight him, on the grounds that the Orangeman, quote, was beneath the station of a gentleman and not a worthy opponent, end quote. And that is where we will leave Ogle Gowan, pricked in both bum and spirit. Next time on The Irish in Canada, we'll explore the controversial execution of a despicable Irishman that changed the course of Canadian history. Thanks for listening to The Irish in Canada. The show was researched, written, and narrated by me, Jane McGaughey. This season was edited and mixed by Patrick McMaster and produced by Marianne Mulvena. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kate Bevan Baker, and our logo was designed by Claire McCauley. Many thanks to the School of Irish Studies at Concordia University in Montreal, the Canadian Irish Studies Foundation, Le Gouvernement de Québec, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada for their support. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. You can spread the word about The Irish in Canada by following us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Irish Canada Pod. Our website is theirishincanadapodcast.ca. That's where you can find show notes for our episodes, including lists of sources and recommendations for further reading. Until next time, Gorama Agif.